Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Hello there and good morning. Coming up in today's show, the former Primate of All-Ireland, Robin Eames, and how we can move on when communities are torn apart. Also, Eurovision star Niamh Kavanagh on how her husband's stroke has made her family stronger. Actor Barry McGovern on the constant pull of Beckett for him. And we love live music from singer-songwriter Sam Wickens, who's been called the new Jeff Buckley. You can text our show on 51551. You can email Miriam at rt.ie. And you can, of course, find me on Twitter at Miriam O'Cal. First this morning to some live music in our studio is Sam Wickens. He's come all the way from Bangor in County Down this morning. He's been anointed by legendary music producer Tony Visconti as one of his biggest rising stars. And you're very welcome into studio, Sam. I'm going to talk to you later on. But first of all, you're going to sing for us one of your own songs, Ravens and Crows. And you're accompanied this morning here in our studio, Sam, by cellist Laura McFadden. Off you go, Sam. Beautiful, Sam. I'm not surprised Tony Visconti, the legendary music producer, took you under his wings. That's your new single, Ravens and Crows, is going to be released, of course, on April the 26th. Yes. Thanks so much. You're going to go off and have a cup of tea in our canteen with Laura and come back towards the end of the show. We'll have a chat. Thanks so much, Sam. Well, Barry McGovern, as many of you will know, is one of our finest actors with a long and illustrious career ranging from Braveheart, Ballycus Angel, Game of Thrones. But of course, it's the greats of Irish literature which have been the most sustaining for Barry, especially the work of Samuel Beckett, which he's been drawn to again and again. And he is regarded as one of the greatest interpreters of Beckett's work. And ahead of a production of one of Beckett's novels, What, at the Project Theatre in Dublin and the Pavilion in Dunleary, I'll give the dates later. I'm pleased to say that Barry's in studio with me now. Good morning, Barry McGovern.
Good morning, Miriam.
You just love Beckett, don't you?
Well, I do, yes.
Yeah.
I do.
Why?
Because he's such a great writer and because he's so funny. I mean, it's a very dark humour, but it's a humour that particularly appeals to me. And there was just something in his work when I first came across it that really just struck a chord with me. And I just found it, you know, a wonderful, wonderful writing and very, very funny.
And every time you do, and you're going to read an excerpt in a moment for us from Watt, but do you interpret it differently every time you do his work or not?
I don't know, really. I've done a lot of his plays and I've done a number of one-man shows based on the novels. And the novels aren't so frequently read as his plays are seen, and they're a wonderful mine of comedy and of situation that, you know, it's a shame people don't read them more. Whether I do them differently or not, I don't. I suppose over the years, when I did I'll Go On, my show based on the three novels, Malloy, Malone Dies, The Unnameable, I mean, I was in my late 30s, yeah. You know, so that's a long time ago, and I suppose it's changed. What hadn't been done for 6 years until Tom Creed, the producer, the director, and I brought it to the Melbourne Festival last October. So it's changed a bit. The set has changed a bit. The costumes, we've more or less, the text is the same. But I suppose over the years it would change, but I wouldn't notice it. It's like, you know, getting older.
Yeah.
You know, looking at photographs, saying, oh God, that's 10 years ago. But you don't notice the change because it's gradual.
You don't notice it yourself. You met him, did you? You met Beckett?
I did. I met him on a few occasions in the last few years of his life, yeah. Yeah. Amazing man.
Was it important to meet him? Did he know you had been interpreting his work and doing his work?
Yes, because he gave Michael Colgan and myself in the gate when we did I'll Go On in 1985 permission to do it, and we'd been in correspondence with him, or Michael had, and I don't know why he gave permission, but I did hear from somebody close to him later that he knew of me because I'd done Endgame in 1984 with Godfrey Quigley in the Peacock with the Abbey Theatre, and I think some word had got back to him. That's what I was led to believe. I don't know whether it's true or not, but we met him in April 86, I think, which was the month of his 80th birthday, and it was great. It was wonderful, yeah.
Did he give you a box of chocolates?
Well, you've done your research. myself and my wife Maeve and my stepson Barra, who's now 38, I think, or 7. He was only 6 at the time, and he was wearing his little FAI jersey, don't mention the war. And it was just the time of the whole, you know.
Yeah. Saipan.
1988, yeah. So no, it was long before that. But it was, we'd met him, and Barra was there playing out in the courtyard or something, and then he said, oh, we'll have to get a present for Barra when he was leaving. So he brought this box of chocolates and gave it to him. It was in our fridge for about 6 months.
Yeah,
I
got
mild. You know, he wanted to eat Beckett's chocolates because they were given by Samuel Beckett.
Too special.
Yeah.
Tell us about What, then. I mean, What? Not everyone will know what it's about.
They
Tell
won't.
Us about it.
It's a very strange novel. He wrote it during the war. He started it in Paris in the 40s and wrote it when he was down in Roussillon in the southeast of France, when he was almost captured by the... He was working for the French underground, and he'd escaped with his partner, later his wife Suzanne, down to the southeast of France, where he worked as a sort of manual labourer on farms and so on for a couple of years, and did some spy work as well for the Allies. Translations and things like that, microfiche stuff. And he wrote it down there as a means of staying sane, as a means of keeping his hand in, as he said. But it's the weirdest, I mean, to call it a novel, it's the weirdest piece of writing, but it is very, very wonderful. It's a very strange novel, but he wrote it, as he says, just to keep his hand in, and it's full of kind of, it's a novel about obsession, really, and about a guy who goes to this guy's house. The guy's called Watt, and he travels on a train to Mr. Knott's house, Watt, Knott, K-N-O-T-T. And he works there as a servant. When one leaves, a servant arrives, the one on the top floor, the first floor, leaves, and then one on the ground floor moves to the top floor. It's a circularity of servants. And of course, the end of my show, he's leaving, but at the beginning, he's arriving.
And you're going to read something for me now from that.
I will. There's a gardener called Mr. Graves who has some domestic troubles, which you can read as erectile dysfunction, if you like, and that's needed to talk about this passage here. So anyway, this is one day they were all four in the garden, Mr. Knott, Watt, Arthur and Mr. Graves. Arthur was standing on the lawn talking to Mr. Graves. Mr. Graves was leaning on a fork, but the great mass of the empty house was hard by, a bound, and they were all in safety. Arthur said, "Do not despair, Mr. Graves. Some day the clouds will roll away, and the sun, so long obnubilated, burst forth for you, Mr. Graves, at last." "Not a kick in me, Mr. Arthur," said Mr. Graves. "Oh, Mr. Graves," said Arthur, "do not say that." "When I says a kick," said Mr. Graves, "I means a..." He made a gesture with his fork. "Have you tried Bando, Mr. Graves?" said Arthur. "A capsule before and after meals in a little warm milk, and again at night before turning in. I had tried everything and was thoroughly disgusted when a friend spoke to me of Bando. Her husband was never without it, you understand. 'Try it,' she said, 'and come back in 5 or 6 years.' I tried it, Mr. Graves, and it changed my whole outlook on life. From being a moody, listless, constipated man, covered with squames, shunned by my fellows, my breath fetid and my appetite depraved, for years I'd eaten nothing but high-fat rashers, I became, after 4 years of Bando, vivacious, restless, a popular nudist, regular in my daily health, almost a father, and a lover of boiled potatoes. Bando, spelt as pronounced. Mr. Graves said he would give it a trial. 'The unfortunate thing about Bando,' said Arthur, 'is that it is no longer to be obtained in this unfortunate country. For the state, taking as usual the law into its own hands, and duly indifferent to the sufferings of thousands of men and tens of thousands of women all over the country, has seen fit to place an embargo on this admirable article from which joy could stream at a moderate cost into homes and other places of rendezvous now desolate. It cannot enter our ports, nor cross our northern frontier, if not in the form of a casual, hazardous and surreptitious dribble. I mean piecemeal in ladies' underclothing, for example, or gentlemen's golf bags, or the hollow missile of a broad-minded priest, where on discovery it is immediately seized and confiscated by some gross customs official half-crazed with seminal intoxication and sold at 10 and even 15 times its advertised value to exhausted commercial travellers on their way home after a non-profitable circuit."
Great excerpt there from Watt. Is there one piece of his work, if you had to choose, it's probably like saying who's your favourite child, but if you had to choose a piece of Beckett, because you've loved and interpreted him so much, is there one you like above others, or one you like doing above all others of his work?
Well, Endgame is probably my favourite play of his. There's something about it. To me, it's a sort of modern-day King Lear. And I've played Clove in Endgame so many times. First of all, at college in Dramstock in UCD as a student, and then about 5 times professionally. And I have a strange love of that piece. And actually, it was Beckett's favourite play too. I told him once, I said, "You know, Endgame is my favourite play of yours." And he says, "Mine too." So, and Godot was always great to do. I mean, to do it with Johnny Murphy all those years was just a wonderful experience. And I was so privileged to do it. And of course, there's a wonderful new Druid production of it that's come out in the last few years, which I've seen a couple of times. It's absolutely wonderful. So there's always a new generation to do Beckett.
And learning it.
I think Molloy is probably his greatest novel, in my opinion, but it's a wonderful, wonderful work. But there's a strange fascination in Watt for me that it tickles my fancy in some way.
And of course, there are people who still, and this is probably heresy to you, Barry, that find his work quite impenetrable, or find it still tricky to be fair.
It isn't easy. There's no point in it is difficult. Some of it is very difficult, but there are lots of his works which are much more approachable than others. And I would say, if you're getting into it, don't start with something obscure. Even Murphy, his early novel, I have to keep going to a dictionary every time I come to it, even though it's a wonderful novel, because he loves the use of arcane words. But if you're very weird like me, you can start with Watt. But I would really start with Molloy and then go on to Malone Dies. And then,
so there's someone listening things.
Yeah, but I think give it a good 50 pages, because if you don't like it, then you're not going to like it. But it's just his use of language and his situation is it's all about what it is to be alive in the 20th century, and now the 21st. But of course, he died in 1989. But I mean, it's like Dante or Shakespeare. It's he's writing about the great things in the world, the whole nature of existence, you know.
And when you meet someone as you did, so brilliant, was it intimidating to meet him? Did he carry his brilliance lightly?
Well, it was intimidating at first, but after a few moments it wasn't, because he was so kind and so gentle. And he was not a man for small talk, but very witty, very, very funny. So it was such a joy, but I was nervous before I met him, of course, because if you'd asked me who would I most like to meet in the world, it probably would have been him.
And of course, as I said, What, Barry, by Samuel Beckett, is on at the Product Arts Theatre from the 9th to the 13th of August, and then at the Pavilion in Dunleary from the 18th to the 20th of April. Thanks so much for taking the time to come in to chat to us this morning.
You're very welcome,
Barry.
Thank you.
My privilege. We'll take a break.
Tweet at Miriam O'Cal. Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
But our text number is 51551. You can email Miriam at rte.ie, and of course you can find me on Twitter at Miriam O'Cal. Well, she has represented us twice at Eurovision, winning of course in 1993 for that great song In Your Eyes.
My feelings locked inside. Made myself an island. Try to take my heart and hide. I built a wall around me. Afraid of letting go. But suddenly an open door I never saw before. In your eyes, I see the light leading me home again.
And of course, Niamh Kavanagh went on to represent us again in 2010. She's now had a very long career in music, performed with the Illegals and also with her husband, Paul McGahey, in their tour Date Night. And she's, of course, here with me in studio. Good morning, Niamh Kavanagh. Does it bring that time back to you when you hear it?
26 years ago. I can't believe it.
You look exactly the same,
Well, thank you very much. Yeah. Not up close, to be fair, but you know, I can do the illusion. Yeah, it is quite funny, actually, 26 years ago. And yeah, I revisit it regularly, obviously, because people want to revisit it with me. But the truth is, I have done so many other things in the last 26 years. Sometimes I have to think about it a little bit, but I am as joyful about it now as I was back then. You know, and actually even 2010 has the same experience for me, even though we didn't do quite as successfully, you know, but for me, 2010 is just as important. It was really fantastic.
Yeah, because some people regard the Eurovision as maybe an albatross, but in fact, it kickstarts your career, really, doesn't it?
Well, I think anybody who would object to singing, to be known for singing in front of 350 million people really hasn't got quite the right priority going on. But for me, music is music. And if you get to do what you want to do for as long as you want to do it, does it really matter? You know, I think other people want to define you, but I don't let myself be defined by that. I do so many different things. And to be honest, for 32 years that I've been gigging, which is like bizarre to say that in a sentence, you know, 32 years of gigging, I have done ridiculously fabulous things. In the 90s, early 90s, I went and sang at the Grammys. I sung in Los Angeles for Bette Midler, you know, all part of the Commitments and thing. I've travelled all over the world. I have recorded in Nashville. I've recorded here. I've played down in Middleton. It doesn't matter where you do it. You can play to 7 people or 350 million people, but the experience is still the same. It should be very sharing and beautiful, and just do what you want.
And you enjoy it.
I love to sing, yeah.
So look, you were performing in Cork last October, weren't you, I think, when you got a call that meant you effectively put your own life on hold at that time.
Well, things changed drastically in one very moment. I was actually down doing the Eurovision show with Paul Harrington and Linda and Charlie, and we were all down in Cork finishing up the tour. And I remember we were in the Opera House and we were having a wonderful tour. It was really fun because we were doing classic Eurovision songs. And in between times, the guys were doing their kind of solo bits, and I had about 5 or 6 songs, and I got the usual text from my eldest boy, can you give me a ring, you know?
Because how old was he about then?
He's 17. Okay. And he texted me to say, could I call him? And so I rang him because I had a break in the show. And I rang him thinking that he was going to look for a lift home, which is quite regular, even though I told him I was going to Cork, the other end of the country. But it turned out that actually my husband, Paul, had an ischemic stroke, and the boys were magnificent. They rose to the occasion in a way that I wasn't expecting, because, you know, you kind of given out about them. They're not picking up their clothes and all that. And yet when they dealt with their father, who they went through the thing, you know, the fast.
Right, yes.
And they asked the questions, they rang the ambulance, they got the boys, and then they rang me. They didn't go in the ambulance because they couldn't, they were too young.
Yeah.
And because they were 17 and 15. And so in one phone call, I mean, I still had to go out and sing Waterloo and making a mind about that. I'm not really sure. That's the nature of what I do. You know, you don't always get to choose what you do in that moment. But I had to make sure I got home then, of course, to go the up there. Because I'd driven down 5.5 miles, I waited till the morning because there was a storm coming through as well. So it probably wouldn't have been wise if I'd been in the ditch. So I arrived up to find my husband really struggling with speech. And, you know, this man, very capable man, very beautiful man, and played music with me for years. And in that moment, he doesn't know what's happening to him. I don't know what's happening. We don't know how long this is going to be. And you hear about stroke, but you don't actually know how it's going to affect you as a person, because each person is affected differently depending on which part of the brain is affected and for how long, you know, which is the other thing. So I found within 24 hours that I was sitting, I went from being on the Opera House, being very glam, because Linda always makes me wear the good shoes and the good dress, and sitting in my front room with a folder so thick that, you know, looked like I'd done a full course on a PhD on something, all about information about the stroke and what needed to happen next, and realising that I was the one who had to make it happen because Paul wasn't in any real state to deal with it just initially. He had all the work to do from the speech point of view because it turned out he had aphasia, which is basically he lost access into his word bank. And for someone who is a journalist, that's quite a shock and a musician. So it was quite a big change for us as a couple. And as a family, in some ways, it's been challenging for 5 months in the sense that there's a little bit more patience required in what you do. And then I had to go away and think and learn about speech therapy because there wasn't a speech therapist available immediately. So I had to go and find someone privately. And weirdly, there are very few people who deal with aphasia in adults in the area. So that was quite difficult. But we found a fantastic woman. And in this modern age, I found an app on that actually helped him. And also, I 2 days in, I handed him a guitar and told him he's no good to me unless he can play the guitar. And so I think I was trying to encourage him to see that he still had a lot of himself in there. He recovered reasonably quickly in the first few weeks. You do find that it does happen. But for me, it meant that I had to centre myself back into the house much more than I had been doing, because if you're, you know, the kids get older, we're touring and I'm doing my individual work as well.
Yeah.
I travel quite a bit with that. So it was important for me to be home because he needed it for his confidence. I needed it for my confidence that he was good and that the boys wouldn't be stressed about dealing with it. But It doesn't just happen to the person it happens to. I think it happens to everybody in the vicinity. But we were very blessed because we have a great sense of humour anyway. Anybody who's seen us in concert will tell you the banter is very much a part of who we are. And so we use humour to get through situations. And he is playing now, back playing the guitar and singing. Singing is a little bit more selective because obviously it's a little bit Swedish Chef in places, as they say, from the Muppets. You know, and it's quite funny because sometimes words just don't come out when he wants them to. But he's improving all the time. And so we delayed the date night second base, which is this round of tour, for later in this year rather
which
than...
Which is where you go out together and
yes,
play.
Yes, just the two of us. It's called date night because if you're at one of those gigs, you're at our date, really. We don't socialise the way we think we should, you know, but we've been together a long time. So that's how we enjoy going out together, you know, so...
When you got off the stator that night to go to the hospital to be with Paul, were dreadful things going through your head about what it was going to be like?
I had no idea.
Stroke is quite scary.
It is scary. I think people immediately think that they're going to be completely debilitated. They don't know what's going to happen. I didn't know what I was going to go up and face. I didn't know what I was going to walk into. And actually, when he won't mind me telling you this, when I walked in the door, he burst into tears because for him in that moment, he was able to let go and go, you know, I hope this is how he thought, you know, basically that I was there to take over because people were talking to him about it and he couldn't voice it because of the speech end of things were affected. And I think you don't realise how much you take for granted being able to just access things, you know, lyrically in your head, certain words, and then for that to be taken away from you. And you know what you want to say. He can see the words in his head. He just can't get it out.
Get them out.
And well, he is different now. He's progressed an awful lot now. But, you know, it's just, it's it's just going to be its time. You know, I mean, I joke about it and say he's at the stage now where, you know, when you go to Weight Watchers with loads of weight to lose and everybody's very supportive in the first while, and then you're down to your last 4 pounds and everybody's forgotten and they don't care anymore. Yeah. But you still have those 4 pounds to get. And it's that frustration of trying to get that last bit of what makes you in there. And he may never get all of it back, you know, the truth is, because that area dies. It's really about accessing in. So we've been very lucky because he's retained a lot of himself. But I think for me, you know, dealing with him, it's been a little bit more involved for us as a relationship to change even how we are, so that I don't become mammy. You know, it's very important. He doesn't, that doesn't happen. You know, so it's been a wonderful experience for us in some ways. It sounds weird to say that because we have had to spend more time together, because you do get a bit disparate as the kids get older and you're doing your individual things. And we've had to ask the questions, are you all right? How do you feel about this? You know, there's a lot of couple therapy going on in it, you know, and it's been really fantastic because we have discovered we still like each other quite a lot, even well, that's great.
And it's amazing how great your young boys were, like 17 and 15. That's still very young for
young
boys.
You have no idea. Paul and I were despairing over the fact that they wouldn't lift the clothes off the floor and they won't do their studying and they're too busy trying to get out to the club. And they just then rise so magnificently to the occasion. Yeah. I mean, I can't tell you how amazingly fabulous they were and how proud we were of them. I mean, I have faith in them that they are these people, but you know, you don't always see them in the nitty gritty of every day. But in that one moment, we discovered the true strength of our boys, which is pretty phenomenal. And in some way, maybe a little reflective glory that all those years of us teaching them things has taught them to deal calmly in those situations. You know, I'll take a little bit of that too.
Absolutely. And do you ever think, even when people go through profound experiences, which that is,
yes, it is huge. Yeah.
Has it? You've spoken about how it changed your relationship, but has it changed you and the things you used to worry about or you do
very
worry
much
about?
Yeah. Very much, ma'am. I, you know, in that one instant, we could have gone from, you know, because we both earn, we both do our thing, and we do a lot of work together. You know, in that moment, we could have lost that connection. We could have lost things. Maybe I wouldn't have been able to travel anymore if he'd been, you know, much more affected by the stroke. You become, in that moment, a different person. But actually, what I've learned over the time is that I am stronger, that I am this, and that I do need him and love him as he is. And our relationship has grown because of that, but also us as me as a person has grown. And also, I don't want to delay going back into the studio to do more work. I don't want to delay doing what I do. I mean, I'm 51 now. Last year I started date night because I wanted to do something for myself, and I just want to continue doing that. I just want to do what I want to do, and because at any given moment that could be taken away. You know, a couple of years ago when I had my thyroid out and they told me I might not be able to sing again, I had a desperate moment in that. So in some ways it's moderated by that, in the sense that it's not so shocking because I had my own revelation in regards to something taken away from you. But, you know, you can regain it, and it's about finding your new normal in that. And it doesn't, you don't have to define it from what you were before. As a matter of fact, you can almost create something new and wonderful from it. And that's, I'd rather go down that road than to be going, oh, woe is me, I don't have this thing. And I have discovered that during this process, and it's been really beautiful to share it with Paul, even in the moments when I want to like raise my eyes so high they're like rolling back in my head, because it's not as easy sometimes to deal with, you know, the patience that's required in it. And I, but in my head, every time I do that, I think about how much more patience he needs to deal with the fact that he's the actual one living it. I can go out and have a pint and give out about it. You know, he goes out and has a pint, but he can't quite give out about it the same way, you know. But I encourage him to go back to his real life as much as possible. It's about regaining your confidence in that. So that's why we're back doing the date night tours this year and back in gigging, because he's a beautiful musician, but also the relationship between us is very much a part of that. And so I'm very keen to kind of get that back out and then get people involved. Anybody who's at my gigs, they know they're more involved than they want to be at any given moment. We do group singing in it and everything. You've no choice. You're in it or not.
Our listeners love you anyway. Oh, Miriam, a beautiful person. Donna's proud. Well done, Niamh. And another says, actually Sharon in Dublin says, Miriam, I'm so sorry to hear about Niamh's husband's stroke. They're both terrific artists and a wonderful couple. I've attended many of their concerts. Brilliant. I hope Paul makes a speedy recovery. Of course, you were telling me you came down from Carrickfergus this morning. You live in beautiful Carrickfergus,
do,
don't
by
you?
The water.
By the water.
By the water, my love. I love it. I absolutely love it. And actually, you know, I love what's wonderful about the fact that I live up there is that I can come home also. It's only a couple of hours down the road. They improved the road beautifully just in time for me to kind of come down. I really love it. But Carrickfergus is beautiful by the water, and actually the sun was shining this morning. Beautiful, lovely drive down, and fresh faced and lovely now. I may have a nap on the way home.
Not when you're driving, hopefully.
No, maybe. But you know, it's so joyful to come home. It really is.
And the lovely thing is you're playing at the Riverbank in Naas on the 12th of June, aren't you?
That's right. We're kicking off the date night. Now, it's a process over a few months. So we'll be doing places like the Visual in Carlow, and then we'll be in Tinnehealy, and we'll be in the Civic. We'll have all these dates that will slot in over the next few months. So I'm really hopeful that the people who want to come, they go on to neavecavanagh.net/shows or come on the Facebook and see us. They'll see the dates coming up. All our regulars kind of come. Paul is playing and singing just as fabulous as ever, so don't be worrying. And you'll have plenty of couples therapy during it. It's really fun and great singing.
More of our listeners, Miriam says, "Hi Miriam, just so moved by Niamh's interview. She's so open and practical about all of it. Please send her best wishes and improving good health for her husband Paul." Loving your programme as always. Actually, that's from Doreen McNeil. And one more says, "Miriam, well done to Niamh and family, and thank her for singing." That's from Margaret. Now we're going to go out listening to your new single, which is Romeo's Twin.
Yeah, Romeo's Twin. It's a beautiful song I recorded in Nashville with John Jennings, a wonderful producer, and Mary Chapin Carpenter singing backing vocals on it. I mean, you know, to be fair, I at the sound desk listening to that, I couldn't believe she was even in the room, but there you go.
Yeah. Well, look, congrats to you, Niamh.
Well, thank
best
you.
Of luck with everything, and the very best to you, and of course to Paul.
Tweet at Miriam O'Cal. Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Our text number 51551. You can email Miriam at rt.ie. Well, my live musical guest this morning, of course, is the young singer-songwriter from Bangor County Down, Sam Wickens. Lots of people, Sam, you sang for us earlier. Lots of people loving your song. And of course, the legendary music producer, Tony Visconti, who was so instrumental in the careers of Bowie and others. He took you under his wing a little, hasn't he? Tell me about that, how you met him, how he came across you.
After talking with the Sky Arts team for a good while, they invited me down to Dublin, where I met with Imelda May, and we were in Windmill Studios, and we were just having a jam session, playing through a lot of, you know, the backlog of Tony Visconti's work, and then she asked me, just down and outright, "Do you want to come on the show?" And I said, "No." And then I said yes. And then, yeah, we done the show and she was an absolute hit. So she was. Antonio, he was running about. He was Johnny on the mark. So he was. I have to give him credit. You know, I've never been involved in a TV show or anything like that before, but he was just getting involved with everyone and anyone that he could throughout the show.
And what effect, when you have someone like that who does rate you, does it give you confidence in your own music, Sam?
Yeah, it gives confidence, not just within your own music, but with you as an individual, you know, to be, you know, just accepted by someone with that respect and, you know, all of his work that he's done. It just makes you feel heard, and that's what any musician wants, is they just want to be listened to and they want to be heard. And from someone like him, it means a lot.
Okay, you're going to sing for us now. And obviously, just to let people know, Sam, you're doing a Jeff Buckley tribute night on May the 11th at the OEA Music Centre in Belfast. You're also at the Black Box in Belfast on June the 13th. You're going to be doing an Irish tour over the summer. What song of yours are you going to go out singing for us now?
Well, I'll be singing a song called Jericho.
Great.
And that's off the upcoming album that will be released later this year in June.
And you're accompanied here in our Studio 7 this morning by the cellist and backing vocalist Laura McFadden.
Yes.
Off you go, Sam. And thanks for coming in to speak to, sing for us this morning, Sam Wickens. Very best of luck with everything.
I'm I'm staying low. You wanna get caught now, don't. Not in Jericho. Fighting on a loaded gun. Fight. Oh,
so much, Sam Wickens there, accompanied by Laura McFadden. Thanks for coming all the way from Bangor to be with us this morning, and very best of luck with your career. I'm now going to speak to another Northern voice. Well, in Christchurch, New Zealand, as the bodies of those in the mosque atrocity recently are buried, the families and their friends left behind are of course incredibly traumatised and attempting to make sense of the absolute senseless. One new widower has publicly forgiven his wife's killer, but forgiveness for so many of us does not come that easily. And on this island, we're too well aware of the difficulty in reconciliation. And we were reminded so recently, of course, of the pain both of the Bloody Sunday families and of the Birmingham bombings families. Well, one man who has helped to bring the communities together to try to reconcile towards a peaceful future on this island is Lord Robin Eames, retired Archbishop of Armagh and former Primate of All Ireland. He joins me now from his home in Hillsborough. Good morning, Robin. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning. It's lovely to talk to you.
Now, let's remind people, of course, yourself and Dennis Bradley, you co-chaired the consultative group on the past. Do you think we're getting any better, Robin, at learning from the past and reconciling at this stage?
This is one of the big questions I think that all of us have to face at the moment. When Dennis and I, together with our team, produced that report, seemed years ago now, we had to tackle for the first time at that stage the whole question of the legacy. What was left after the Troubles? What was possible in terms of building a better future? But first of all, we had to face up to the stories of numerous people who came out of the woodwork and who wanted to tell their story, and they wanted to look for justice. They wanted to look for a hearing. And I think for the first time, if I may say so, our effort was to try and tie that in with the reality of what was possible. And when we got the reaction to that, it was overwhelming, because people wanted to talk about getting someone into court to answer for what they thought was the crime against them. They wouldn't be happy, I think, or see justice unless they saw someone in the dock. Secondly, there were those people who simply wanted to say, we want to know what happened. We just want to be told what was the story of our loved one losing their life. And the third group, which has emerged even more strongly of latter days, was the group that simply said, look, we want to get on with our lives. We want to try and push on despite what has happened to us. And those three categories produced what we now call as the victim and the survivor unit in our society. And then when we talk about the trauma of that, Miriam, we're reminded, as you said just now, about what's happened in New Zealand, the Birmingham bomb, the Bloody Sunday situation. It all brings back the basic question of what do we want as individuals? What is it we're looking for when we talk about justice? What is it we're looking for when we talk about reconciliation? And the two levels of that, of course, are person to person on the individual level, and the bigger question of how does a society cope with that? And to add to that, if I may, the restlessness at the moment about Brexit, it's all bringing division to the surface, which we hoped and prayed had largely subsided. And that's the position that I see at the moment, but it's all tied up with this word legacy.
And of course, in the Eames-Bradley report, many of your proposals, they haven't been implemented, have they, Robin? I mean, is that a source of frustration? And do you think things could have been implemented that would have made a difference?
Well, there are two things about that. First of all, many of the thoughts that we put may not have been implemented exactly as we said it, but they keep rising. People turn around day after day to me and say, look, you said this, we want that to pass, we want that to happen. And there are others who simply say, this report is not gathering dust on the shelves, and it's finding a form in proposals that are coming to the fore, not only at government level and political parties level, but within society as a whole, we're still being asked to see what the questions we raised or the answers we proposed have a relevance for today. And I like to think that some of the thinking which we did, because there's one thing that I must emphasize, it was a listening exercise. It was people who made the proposals that we put into paper. It was people and their reactions. And while the years have passed and many attempts have been made, including the Good Friday Agreement and the ending of violence, while all that has happened, some of the proposals as regards the way forward are still on the map. And to that extent, I suppose it illustrates the fact that basically we're talking about human reaction to situations over which we had no control. Mm. And that's why the New Zealand situation is one which has, to me at least, produced one more reflection on things that don't change. I mean, how do the people of New Zealand, and they've been magnificent in the way they have reacted. I can't speak too highly of the actions of the New Zealand Prime Minister and the way in which people have flocked to pay respect to those who have suffered so much. To bring it right up to date, I'm in touch with the Muslim leaders in Great Britain. And of course, I was saying to them since the last few days, our thoughts are with you. And what they're saying back to me is simply this: we can't understand this, but we dread what this could provoke in retaliation or in a breakdown of relationships that have been carefully built up. And some of us are working with those groups to make sure, if possible, we safeguard them against anything like that in these islands.
And you mentioned there, obviously, the leadership of the Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern. But in a sense, Robin Eames, are we lacking that in Northern Ireland on both sides? And also, I also find interviewing people down the years on both sides of the divide, Robin, people feel sometimes there's a hierarchy of atrocity, or that there's some kind of a monopoly in loss of grief by both sides. I mean, we're very divided and we don't seem to have the leadership right now up there to bring us forward.
Well, I think we've got to read that against the restlessness, as I call it, of Brexit. People just don't know what lies around the corner. I mean, the news this weekend of the way in which talks at Brussels have gone or haven't gone. People in the business community here, people in the political arena and people in ordinary life situations. When I was the Archbishop of Armagh, I knew intimately the situation along our border. I knew it on both sides, and I knew the people there and some of the frustrations they had. And when we got the Good Friday Agreement, when we got the Stormont House Agreement, when we got all these agreements at a high level, people began to breathe more easily. And relations person to person were good.
Mm-hmm.
Now we've got a restlessness, and you know as well as I do that affects people in their everyday lives and in their everyday work. And that restlessness is the very last thing we need as we build in what's become known by everyone as the peace process. But we haven't yet achieved that level of understanding, that level of being willing to stand where the other person stands, and to be able to listen to what is genuine feelings on both sides. I remember in the days in which I was involved in the early days of the peace process, one of the things we learned was you cannot legislate for reconciliation. You can't pass an act of parliament or an act in Dublin, in the Dublin Senate or so on, and say this is reconciliation. You can set the framework for it. And that's what has been done through the years by very, very careful planning. But you cannot impose reconciliation by the signing of a document or the passing of a law until people in their hearts and in their minds know what's involved, willing to take risks, willing to listen, willing to, as the person of faith would say, pray their way into the future. Until you get that, you're going to have restlessness. And then along comes Brexit. Its effect on Northern Ireland, its effect on the people in your jurisdiction, the effect on the island as a whole. Of course, there's going to be a wandering. There's going to be a restlessness. And the sooner we get this settled one way or the other, the better.
How do you, both in terms of the, you know, the great work you did in terms with Dennis Bradley of trying to bring up some kind of a reconciliation solution, but how do you ultimately, you were saying earlier, Robin, that people just wanted to be heard, or they wanted to know what happened to their loved ones, or they wanted someone to be brought to justice. But if that doesn't happen, how do you get people to forgive, and how do you get people to overcome that loss and to move on? How do you do that?
Do you mind if I answer you by reflecting on something that happened in the past?
Yeah.
I went at 37 years of age as the Church of Ireland Bishop of Derry in the aftermath of Bloody Sunday. Across the city on another hill was Edward Daly, who was to become one of my closest friends. He had responsibility to his people, as I try to have responsibility to mine. We were both roughly of the same age. We were definitely of the same outlook. And we decided the first step to try and make reconciliation a fact was to be showing the world, showing the community in the north here, that we could get on, that we could talk, we could pray together, we could take initiatives together, simply by being person to person, knowing that we could disagree on certain things, but that basically we could listen to each other and make some understanding. Now, Edward sadly is gone. But I still remember that the days that we tried to do those things together had, we believe, an impact on ordinary people who had fears, resentment, differences, because they thought, well, if these two
leaders
can do things together, then surely, you know, there's something could be done. We're not, I wouldn't, if Edward were here, I can hear his voice in my ear saying to me, don't claim too much. And I'm not trying to claim too much, but I'm thinking we showed the way not in laws or written documents, but by simply on the ground, feet on the ground, reality of saying there's more than unites us than divides us.
Well, look, Lord Romneams, I wish I could talk to you for longer, actually, but I will, preferably, hopefully, maybe on prime time. Thanks so much for taking the time to speak to us this morning, Robin Eames. And Thank you for talking to me. Yeah, my privilege. We'll talk to you again. That's it from this week for our show. Mark Dwyer was on sound. Laura Lee Davies was our BCO. Sean O'Gorman produced. Thanks so much to you for listening. We'll be here at the same time next Sunday. Until then, slán.